Previously on Beta.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story. And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Risk the game of global domination.
Voice. Pause. Candygram. Woman. Candygram. My foot. You get out of here before I call the police. You're the shark. And you know it.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, journalist Matt Taibbi explains why following the news can be hazardous to your health.
And we're selling you your own rage, basically bottled and amplified. It's emotionally destructive in the same way that cigarettes are physiologically destructive, and we don't think about it as much.
And Lisa Dapolito joins us to talk about her Gilda Radner documentary, Love, Gilda.
She was always looking for that love, you know, whether it was the love of an audience or a love of a person. But that was really Gilda's quest, was always to find that sort of love.
But first, Kevin Allison. Kevin is a comedian, writer, and actor. He's also the man behind the hit podcast, Risk. The show's tagline is, true stories people never thought they'd dare to share. But many people have taken the risk and shared their most intimate secrets, including Kevin himself.
I used to be on this sketch comedy show on MTV called The State in the early 90s, and it was so much fun. It was very early success. But as soon as the group broke up and we lost our TV show in 1996, I spent 12 years just not knowing how to build a solo career. I would go out on stage and play kooky, crazy characters, and no one ever seemed to respond to these characters I was doing.
Why wouldn't they respond? Were they too kooky, too crazy?
Well, no. What it ultimately was that I think my pieces were a little bit too artful, a little bit too written, a little bit like authenticity of some sort or another was somehow not breaking through. People thought my stuff was funny, but for some reason it wasn't hitting a vein. So it was Michael Ian Black, who was also a former member of my sketch comedy group, The State. He came to see one of my solo shows in 2009. And afterwards he said, you know, I feel like the audience just really wanted you to drop the mask. Just stop the acting and get up on stage and tell your own true stories. And I said, oh, God, that sounds so scary to me. I said, there's too many parts of my personality that are complex. You know, like, I'm so gay, and yet I'm also so Midwestern and polite, and yet I can be really absurdist and sometimes really kinky. It's just, I said, it feels too risky to be me up on stage. And he said, that is the idea. If it feels risky, then you're probably really opening up and saying something authentic, and an audience is likely to open up to you. So that was the week that I decided, okay, I'm going to get up on stage and tell a really risky story, a true story as myself, and see what happens.
What Michael Ian Black told you, it was really life-changing, wasn't it?
It really was. And you know what's fascinating when I look back? I remember he used to say things like that to me way back when we were even on MTV. One of the things that I've learned as a storyteller, when you go back and start reconstructing specific incidents that had a real emotional impact on you in your life, you start to realize, oh, I've been relearning some of the same lessons over and over again. So really, it was the first time I heard it, not the first time I'd been told.
Tell me what you did with Michael Ian Black's advice.
There was a theater in New York. Well, it's still there, but it's changed locations. The UCB Theater in New York City. They were putting on a show where people were telling stories about their sex lives, and it was called Stripped Stories. And my friend Margot Lightman was hosting the show. show. I had never seen a true storytelling show before, but I had gotten this advice from Michael, so I decided to contact Margot, and I said, listen, I want to tell a really risky story, so maybe I can tell the story about the time that I unsuccessfully tried prostituting myself when I was 23 years old before the state ever got our TV deal. And she said, oh my God, that sounds great. But on the day of the show, a couple days later, I called her and I said, I have to back out. I'm terrified. This just seems too risky. She said, that's great news. I said, what? She said, oh my God, on the day of the show, because these are stories about people's sex lives, people often like freak out the day of the show and say, oh, this is too personal. This is revealing too much. I feel like it's too risky. And she says, if I can convince that person to do the show anyway, to face their fear and just do it, that is the story that's going to knock it out of the park that night. So she convinced me, and I got up and told that true story. It was Friday, the rent was due on Monday, and he said to me, Kev, I'll tell you something. A lot of people don't realize this, but prostitution can be fun. I said, To tell you the truth, the whole time I'd been living with him, I wasn't sure where he was getting the rent. Well, any other roommate might have suggested to you, hey, Kev, you might ask your parents for a loan. But he already knew that my parents had already said to me, Kevin, we can't possibly give you yet another month's rent. And it was terrifying. Like, I went from moment to moment in the story having all those inner critic voices in my head saying things like, oh, you sound so gay right now, or, ooh, you probably sound really Midwestern right now, you know, like all this stuff that doesn't matter. And the audience just kept leaning more forward because I was just being myself. And I realized, oh my gosh, there is an emotional connection that I'm having with this room tonight that I haven't had on stage since I don't know when or ever. And so I was really shook that night. I walked away from, you know, I was used to people after shows saying to me, hey, that was funny. But now I was having people come up to me and say, gosh, I've never been through an experience like what you described, but the emotions you described were so familiar to me. And oh my God, that triggered a memory of a fight I got into with my dad and mom when I was in the seventh grade or whatever it is. When you tell a true story, if you're really tapping into the most revealing thoughts and feelings you had in an intense moment in your life, it's bound to open up and trigger associations for other people that are just as meaningful for them, even if they've never been through anything like what you just described. So my walk down 8th Avenue after leaving the UCB theater that night was really a transformational walk, because during that walk, the whole show risk started to occur to me. I said, listen, I've been hearing this word risk from Michael Ian Black and then from Margot, and this is it. I think I've tapped into something here. I realized that there were shows where people did tell true stories, like The Moth or in a more journalistic way, This American Life. But I also realized, oh my gosh, there's this new format, podcasting, where you don't have to censor yourself at all. It doesn't have to be family friendly. You can talk about anything. So I knew there must be a niche that I could fill to create a podcast where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share in public. And these stories can be hilarious, they can be horrifying, they can be beautiful and tear-jerking, as long as the person is going outside their comfort zone and speaking with the raw, real honesty that they would normally speak to their therapist with, for example.
That's a great motto. Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share.
People responded to it immediately. That was another thing. As soon as I had this idea, I started pitching it around to friends. people were like, oh my gosh, I get that. I want to see that show. I want to hear that show. I realized that it had to be both a live show and a podcast because I had been dealing with stage fright for the past 12 years. I was very spotty about being able to feel like I could get up on stage. So I was like, I've got to beat this thing by forcing myself to get up on stage on a regular basis. Plus, I had already experienced that thing where when you're really opening up in front of an audience, there's an electricity in that room. So I knew it had to be a live show, but I also knew it had to be a podcast because that's how to reach a much, much, much wider audience. Plus, we do these radio-style stories. So it's not all just stories told live on stage. There are some stories where a person comes to my apartment and just sits down with me and one-on-one shares a story with me, and then we cut me out of it and add music and sound design. So it's a whole audio experience.
You've collected 37 stories from the Risk podcast into this book, which is appropriately called Risk, and you had over 350 episodes worth of stories to choose from. How difficult was it to decide which stories to include?
Oh my gosh, it was so hard. I listened to every episode of Risk to do kind of an inventory and finally take a look back at it all. And I narrowed, the first list I made was 600 possible stories. And then I kept narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. And it's interesting because we finished that book and the very first thing we said was, oh my gosh, I hope we can do another one. Because, you know, there's like so many stories that we didn't include in the book that we think are just as good as everything that's in the book. So yeah, we've got a lot of material, and
it makes me think of that Jaws line, we're going to need a bigger boat. If you have 600 stories, you're going to need a bigger book.
Exactly, exactly. I think we could do a whole series.
A whole bunch of volumes. We could have them lined up like the Encyclopedia Britannica, 26 volumes. Can you identify one of the stories in the book as being the quintessential Risk story? I know that's a tough question.
Oh, you know, there's a story in the book about a guy. He went to a Jesuit high school, so he had a really good upbringing. His family was well enough off and, you know, all that sort of thing. But he started selling drugs in high school. And amazingly enough, he ended up being so proficient at that that he ended up moving down to Mexico and working for a major drug cartel. And at one point, he made a mistake deciding to work with some new, whatever you would call them, client or something like that, and lost, I think, like $150,000 of whatever drug merchandise they had. So he was kidnapped by this drug cartel.
Almost 40 days into this, and I just couldn't live this way anymore. Literally like an animal tied up, being fed once a day, peeing in a milk gallon that had had the top cut out, had not brushed my teeth, had not washed my face, had not taken a shower. I remember I got to one point to where I would look down on my nails and I wanted to cut my nails, I wanted to peel my nails. And something in my mind said, well, if I am gonna wind up dead somewhere, at least, and if they can identify my body, maybe the forensics people can identify the DNA in my nails. So I remember peeling all my nails and putting them in the pocket of my jeans.
Finally, they did, in fact, just let him go. They did, in fact, just want to prove a lesson to him. But it was a life-changing experience for him because he found God, actually, in the process of living through all of that and realized just how much his family did, in fact, love him because they sold everything they had to give ransom money to the drug cartel. It's just one of those stories which is horrifying and brutal, and at times your jaw drops like, oh, I can't believe this is real and that I'm hearing this. In the end of the story, he shares about telling this story to his children, you know, to show them how much he loves them and the life that they've built together as kind of opposed to the man he used to be. So it's those kind of stories that are so surprising, and yet when you hear them, you walk away feeling like, gosh, okay, I really got something out of that person's experience. I lived vicariously a little bit there, and that gives me hope.
Kevin Allison is the host and creator of the podcast Risk. You can find out more about Kevin on our website, wpr.org/beta.
Almost everything that we report is legitimate and true, and they're real problems, but the lie that's built into the coverage is that you can do anything about it.
Journalist Matt Taibbi joins us to talk about how the news is a consumer product designed to keep us awake at night in a constant state of panic. That's just ahead. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Journalist Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. He's also the winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for Columns and Commentary. Matt's latest project is a serial online book called Hate Incorporated: Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. Matt joins us now. Matt, I was wondering, what impact did reading Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky's 1988 book Manufacturing Consent have on you?
It had a huge impact on me because I had grown up in a family of journalists, and I had never thought that there was a propaganda aspect to American journalism. That book was a real eye-opener for me, and it became a guide in my own career. It really describes how propaganda works in America. Obviously, we don't have a system of political commissars who come in and delete your copy, but we do have a lot of internal pressures and unseen propaganda ideas that artificially narrow the conversation, and that's what that book was about.
You've described your new serialized book, Hate Inc., as a rethink of manufacturing consent. Why do you think it needs rethinking?
Well, because that book came out in 1988, just before a whole bunch of really revolutionary things happened to the commercial media system in America. There was the advent of the 24-hour news cycle. The internet was on the way. And then there was a significant business change that was really innovated by networks like Fox News, which was really about segmenting the news audience into different demographics and capturing them, you know, as opposed to going for the widest possible audience. So Chomsky and Herman were really writing about a very different time in American media, and I thought that in this new landscape that's very fragmented and atomized, it would be worth looking to see how their propaganda model held up over time.
So is there one recurring theme that runs through Hate Inc.?
Yes. I think the main theme that runs through the book is that we in the commercial media now are financially incentivized to wind people up and make them angry with each other. Whereas in the old days of media, back in the days when we had three networks and just a couple of newspaper chains, we had exactly the opposite dynamic in media. The idea was to make the audiences less wound up and actually more placid because we were trying to reach the widest possible audience. Now what we do is we have a divided demographic where, you know, MSNBC goes after liberals, Fox goes after conservatives, and the easiest financial route to success is just making those groups angry with each other.
Your father, Mike Taibbi, was an NBC television reporter, and you talk about one of the nightly rituals that you saw him doing when you were a boy. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, my father had this thing called the phone attack. Yeah. I was fascinated by my father's work when I was a kid. He was a television reporter. My childhood was a lot like the movie Anchorman. He used to come home at night, and he would take his Rolodex. That was back when people had Rolodexes. It's a card file for those of you in the digital age that has phone numbers in it. And he would randomly call sources, whether he had something to talk about with them or not, and just sort of keep in touch with people. And this basically taught me that reporting is a job about maintaining relationships, whether or not you actually have to have anything to talk about with sources. And he would do that for hours and hours every night. He would sit there with a highball and a Camel unfiltered cigarette and just make sure that those sources were fresh.
And as you say in the book, it's also important to ask people to talk about whatever they want to talk about, not just one thing in particular.
Right, and this is something that's really been lost in the modern age of reporting, where what happens more often than not now is people sit down and do stories and they look for links to support a thesis that they already have. Whereas the old school of reporting is you just sort of talk to people all the time and you ask them open-ended questions and they tell you, they offer you what they know about things. And so you're not looking for a predetermined thesis. You're not trying to get quotes to fill in a blank that you've already laid out on paper.
Yeah.
So it's a huge difference. The idea of physically talking to people, making it an open-ended conversation, as opposed to what we do now.
What else did you learn about journalism from your dad?
I think, you know, the main thing I learned about work from my father was that reporting is primarily about talking to people. My father is sort of a master at walking into any room and getting people to talk on camera within a couple of minutes. He's a very sort of engaging, jovial person. He was sort of born for the business in a way that I really wasn't. And the way that he does the job is a lot like the way a lot of people back, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s did it. They were sort of inherently iconoclastic. They did not view themselves as part of the power structure. They were always challenging the things that any politician said, whether they were on one party or the other. My father always had that very deep independent streak. He sort of liked to tell other people's stories.
As you point out in Hate, Inc., journalists are now creating content for specific demographics. So how does this focus on demographics shape the journalism you write for Rolling Stone?
Well, it's difficult because I try to fight against that instinct, actually. One of the things that struck me when I came home, I lived overseas for 12 years.
Yeah.
And when I came back to the United States after being in the former Soviet Union, I went to a bookstore and I saw that there were two shelves. There were shelves for Republicans and shelves for Democrats. And you could tell which kind of book was for whom from 10 feet off because they had different kinds of designs. And I thought to myself, that's so weird. Like, what writer automatically wants to turn off half the audience before you even get close to the book? And so as a writer, I want everybody to read what I write. I don't want to limit it to one demographic. I want everybody to be interested in it and potentially to get into the story. I often challenge and disappoint my audience, I think, and that's you know, been a bit of a problem in my career sometimes.
You've used sports analogies to describe presidential campaigns. You've said that the preseason is the straw polls, the regular season is the primaries, and the playoffs are the general election. So it only makes sense that you argue that the media industrial complex has turned the news into sports. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. One of the things is that sports is a format that definitely works commercially, that the networks are familiar with. They know how to sell it. They know how to market it. And we've stolen a lot of things from how we cover sports and transplanted it onto presidential campaigning. You see that a lot, especially on election nights. If you watch election coverage on the cable networks, you'll see that the setup on the sets is almost exactly like a Sunday countdown show for the NFL.
Yeah.
You'll have one analyst from one team, one analyst from another team, and then there are people who make predictions about which team is going to win, and everything becomes about the horse race. We borrow a lot of the language and the stylistic aspects of sports coverage for things like debates, which are just chock full of boxing metaphors from start to finish.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is just a formula because it's easier to train audiences to understand politics as something that they have to root for, as opposed to trying to train them to think in a nuanced way about a very, very difficult subject.
Yeah. You also compare reading the news to smoking. How so?
This kind of content that we're doing nowadays, which is basically about monetizing anger. If you turn on, click on basically any news story through social media, it's geared up to make you upset about something. And Donald Trump is a perfect example of a political story that people just can't have any neutral feelings about. They either love the guy and hate his enemies, or they hate him. And so any story about basically anything involving Trump is going to get people furious. Then they're going to read that. They're going to go to social media. They're going to argue with people about that. And they're going to stay in this emotionally amplified, heightened state of sort of anxiety all day long. And that has an addictive effect. This has been talked about by people who study sort of the way that social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter work, mm-hmm. that people become addicted to the dopamine rush of anger that they get from reading a news story. And we just sort of sociopathically crank this stuff out there and dump it on audiences without thinking about what it does to their mental health. But I think most people would agree that if they stop following the news for any length of time, and you notice this when you go on vacation, that you're just happier. And so this product that we're selling, and we're selling you your own rage, basically bottled and amplified, it's emotionally destructive in the same way that, cigarettes are physiologically destructive, and we don't think about it as much.
Yeah. Do you think that writing so candidly about this idea may be hazardous to your health and your career?
Actually, I found that that writing about all this has been really therapeutic for me, mm-hmm. Because I had all this bottled up for years because I've been struggling against it in the business. And my hope was, in writing this and showing people how the business looks from the inside and what it looks like, what the thought process of a person who creates media content is, that people would be able to protect themselves from some of this a little bit, that maybe they would not get so upset about things that are designed to get them upset.
Yeah.
So it's been, you know, for me personally, it's helped me calm down a little bit. And I hope the book also helps people not take things so seriously.
You have this great trick that you've trained yourself to use before you click on any news story online. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I imagine that I'm opening a box of cigarettes, and it's basically, if I'm going to go outside and have an MSNBC or have a Fox or something like that.
Yeah.
Because here's what people don't think about when they watch the news. They forget that it's a consumer product.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, almost everything else that we buy, we have a heightened sense of consumer awareness these days, whether it's, you know, we watch what we eat, where people are vegans, they count the calories of everything, they think about the products and what's in the furniture that their kids use, but they don't think about what the news is. The news is a consumer product. It's both something that you consume, and you yourself are also a product, because the media company is taking the information that it's getting about your news habits, and it's selling it off to a third party. So you're in the middle of a very complex consumer transaction every time you watch any news content. And people don't think about that. They think the news is just a bunch of people trying to tell you the truth about stuff, but it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah, so if the news is indeed a consumer product, as you argue, does that cheapen your profession and make it more difficult for you to get motivated to devote so much time and effort to writing stories?
Yes and no. I mean, there's still, I think most of the people who do this job, most of the good reporters that I know, they didn't get into this because they wanted to get rich and make a consumer product for a large transnational corporation, which actually most of us end up working for. You know, most of us got into this profession because we wanted to be truth tellers or be writers or make good TV or whatever it is. So we're motivated by the same things that motivated people like Seymour Hersh and Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and Terry Southern and Hunter Thompson, all those people. And, you know, they didn't have commercial motivations, but we're working within a framework that is increasingly commercial. So it's difficult. I think it's in the old days when you were working in the 50s and 60s in media in America, there wasn't the expectation that news had to make money. News was very frequently a loss leader within a bigger company that made money in some other way. Now that's not true. Now if you work for the news, you have to have some kind of successful commercial formula, and that affects everybody's work.
Yeah. As you point out, reporting on homelessness during the Reagan years was a way to denounce the greed is good era. And by talking about this issue, people were showing that they cared. And you refer to how this very idea plays out in the movie based on Bret Easton Ellis's novel American Psycho. Can you tell me about this?
It's this deranged serial killer who, there's a scene where he and his friends are in an upscale restaurant in Soho, and they're talking about the news that day, and they're explaining to each other how much they care about homelessness, and about, one of them talks about how Sri Lanka and all, how all of the Sikhs are massacring all Muslims. Of course, he gets it wrong. That's part of the joke.
Oh, who gives a rat's ass?
Hey, that affects us.
Oh, well, what about the massacres in Sri Lanka, honey? Doesn't that affect us too? I mean, do you know anything about Sri Lanka? How, like, the Sikhs are killing, like, tons of Israelis over there?
Come on, Bryce. There are a lot more important problems than Sri Lanka to worry about.
Like what?
Well, we have to end apartheid, for one. and slow down the nuclear arms race, stop terrorism, and world hunger. We have to provide food and shelter for the homeless and oppose racial discrimination and promote civil rights while also promoting equal rights for women. We have to encourage a return to traditional moral values. Most importantly, we have to promote general social concern and less materialism in young people.
Patrick, how thought-provoking.
But the idea is that the news in American Psycho was just another consumer product that was part of his outward expression of normalcy, whereas, in fact, in the inside, he was crazy. But we do this a lot in America. We talk about the news as if knowing about it is doing something about it. And we think that by educating ourselves about how things are terrible in certain parts of the world or certain problems that are going on, that alleviates the guilt that we feel about not changing the world in the right way. Whereas, in fact, in many cases, it's like something that we wear.
I was really struck by this particular statement you made in Hate Incorporated. You say, quote, "I work in this business and don't know whom to trust," end quote. So that makes me wonder, how are you able to do your job?
It's very difficult. In the last couple of years, that whole segmented demographic problem has gotten, I think, so intense that I don't know if even the most quote-unquote reputable newspapers are always accurately representing things or if they're leaving things out because they're afraid to lose their core audiences. So I actually spend a lot of time now when I want to know about a news story, I just put on my journalist hat and start calling sources to ask them rather than read the news, which is kind of a sad thing. And I think that's where we're headed in the future, is that people are going to increasingly turn to alternative sources because they're going to not trust the traditional sources as much anymore.
Yeah, besides turning to alternative sources, how else do you think the future of journalism is going to play out?
We're facing a number of pretty serious challenges right now. The situation with internet distributors has placed media companies in a dependent position that they were never in before. And in the old days, the power of, for instance, a local newspaper was the fact that it had its own distribution network. It had its own trucks. It had its own distribution points. It had its own paper kids. And they were the only people who could get, for instance, a want ad in front of the eyeballs of 2 million people in a metropolitan area. Well, distribution doesn't matter anymore because the internet reaches everybody. So, the Boston Globe or the Chicago Tribune doesn't have a commercial advantage over the New York Times, even when it comes to its own audience. So the problem of how media companies maintain their own independence when they don't really have control over their own demographics and they don't have as much power as they used to, that's going to be difficult because the revenue streams that we used to count on are gone from, want advertising, from local advertising, the FCC licenses for local broadcasting outlets. They make a lot less money than they used to, so I don't know who's going to be funding important journalism anymore.
Matt Taibbi is an award-winning journalist. He's also the author of Hate Incorporated, Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. You can find out more about Matt at WPR.org/beta.
So many people in comedy are inspired by her. People like Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Tina Fey, who are inspiring now a new generation.
Up next, Lisa Dapolito talks about her Gilda Radner documentary, Love Gilda. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon.
When I was a little girl growing up in Detroit, my dad used to take me to see shows when they'd come into town. And we'd sit in about the third row, and I'd look up on the stage, and the people up there just always looked so happy to be there. And I thought to myself that that's what I wanted to do, and that's where I wanted to be. And I remember when they'd come right down near the foot of the stage and they'd look out, I always was sure they were looking right at me, right at little Gilda Radner. And now that I'm finally up here, I can't see a thing.
Gilda Radner was one of the 7 original Not Ready for Primetime players on Saturday Night Live. She created some of the show's most memorable characters, including Judy Miller, Baba Wawa, and Roseanne Rosanna Dana. Her legacy has inspired the next wave of SNL cast members and comedians. Filmmaker Lisa Dapolito has created a new documentary about Gilda's life and career. It's called Love Gilda. To tell her story, Lisa gained access to exclusive content from Gilda's journals, photos, videos, and even her audio tapes.
Gilda's brother had had these boxes that were in storage since Gilda passed away, and he didn't really know what was in them. Mm-hmm. And it took a little convincing, but Gilda's best friend, Judy, and I convinced him to go into the storage unit and take his boxes out. And in the boxes were the first thing we found was a videotape that Gilda made while she was going through her chemotherapy.
Are you filming now?
Yes, dear.
Oh, I was panicked this time. I didn't want to come for this treatment. I thought if I filmed it, you know, it would add a dimension to take my mind off of it.
And then there were audio tapes in there and photos and her writings and journals. I mean, it took a period of, you know, several trips to Detroit to really get the nerve to, like, take, you know, it's a kind of weird when you have somebody's physical things.
Mm-hmm. If you didn't have access to all of this material, the film wouldn't have been nearly as successful as it is, don't you think?
I think it would have been a typical documentary about people talking about how great Gilda was, and it would show her sketches, and the modern-day comedians would talk about how they were inspired by her. But I think it would have been a traditional doc. So once I heard her audio tapes, I was like, oh, my God, if Gilda could tell her story in her voice, that would be amazing.
I found that my comfort in live television was laughter, that I can do almost anything if people are laughing. That's what hugs me and holds me and gets things out of me.
But one of the problems with it were the audio tapes were severely damaged. It was really, I was on a mission that Gilda was going to tell her story. And there were times that my team were telling me, like, oh, we'll just get an actress in and they could read Gilda's parts. Or we can get somebody who plays, you know, the audience won't know the difference if you're using an actress. And I was like, no, it has to be Gilda. So with a lot of audio work and a team of an amazing dialogue restorer, I think it worked in the end.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered amongst all the material, the audio, the video recordings, the journal?
Well, I guess two things. Listening to Gilda talk, she was obviously really funny in real life, but so intelligent and so acute of people and situations. But I think the most revealing thing was in her journals. Mm. And it was the journal, we use a bit of it in the film, which is about 1978. And it's at the height of Gilda's, her fame. She has an Emmy. She's on the cover of all these magazines. She checked herself into a hospital for her eating disorder. And she kept a diary about her loneliness.
Mm, yeah, right, yeah. You mentioned the importance of Gilda's childhood. Can you tell me a bit about her early years?
Well, Gilda was born her parents were very affluent, and her father was much older when she was born. And she was the apple of his eye. And it was a family that humor was very, very important in the family. So she was always entertaining her father. And I think she was also a chubby child. Uh-huh. So she was made fun of. And her mother put her on diet pills when she was young. So there was something that Gilda never felt. She always felt as an outsider. She felt overweight. And people made fun of her when she was little. And she was able to turn that around by making people laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she also had a nanny from the time that she was born, and her nanny became a big influence in her life. And then when her father died, when she was young, it really impacted her. She was always looking for that unconditional love that she got from her father. And I think that's why she had so many relationships with men, you know, maybe not the positive relationships, but she was always looking for that love. you know, whether it was a love of an audience or a love of a person, but that was really Gilda's quest, was always to find that sort of love.
I am going to kill you right now. Oh, no, no, no! You cannot kill me! Oh, no!
Ah! I would like to take that balance beam and stick it in her eye.
What is that bewitching scent you're wearing?
Vicks Vapor Rub!
Gilda created many very popular characters on Saturday Night Live, and she became very famous very fast. Did she have trouble dealing with her fame?
Well, I think they all became famous really fast,
yeah.
Whole cast. And it was a different period of time where there was only, you know, a couple, I don't know, a dozen television stations at the time. Mm-hmm. And the college students were really the big fans of the show. And they would watch... They would get it. Many people told me they'd get into a dorm room or they'd be like 20, 30 people watching the show. So when the cast did their first show in New Orleans, which was like a year, they did a live show.
Yeah.
There were hundreds or thousands of people mobbing them. And they didn't know how popular that they were, because I think somebody said the Nielsen ratings couldn't really tell because they went by household.
Mm.
So they were really, really popular fast. And in New York, you know, this is the 70s too. So that was a really different time. And I think with Gilda, from what I heard and what she talks about, she loved going out into the street and being among people. And at first she loved being recognized. But then it got to a point where she was really mobbed in places. Her friend had told me that they were in the ladies' room and Gilda was in the bathroom stall, and there were people putting autograph things under the door for her to sign.
I can't tell if guys are looking at me because I'm a girl and maybe just attractive, or if they're just looking at me because they recognize me from the show and I'll maybe never know again.
Being funny got me famous, and being famous is almost as bad for dating as being funny.
Do you think that might be the reason that her first husband was G.E. Smith?
It's so interesting. I tried to interview G.E., but I couldn't get to him because I wanted to hear his point of the story, because nobody in Gilda's life, none of her friends, knew that they were dating.
Huh.
And the relationship kind of came and went so fast.
Yeah, it was just a couple years, right?
And no one really had much to say, and nobody knew why she married him. And, you know, maybe it was the first, somebody said maybe it's the first person that asked her.
Yeah, and then shortly after that, she met Gene Wilder, who became her second husband. How did they meet?
Well, they met on the set of Hanky Panky.
What the hell are you doing in my apartment?
This is Nathan Curry's apartment.
You're a friend of Nathan Curry?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Michael Jordan. He's got my apartment in Chicago. We exchanged apartments.
When did he leave?
I don't know when he left. I've been here a week. The agents in Chicago arranged for it. They didn't say anything about you.
Oh, I'm Kate Hellman. I'm sorry.
How do you
do? I thought you were a burglar.
I thought you were a burglar. Well, when you opened the door, I almost bashed your brains in.
What was Gilda and Gene's relationship like?
Gilda adored him. She wrote to him, you know, she wrote love stories to him. She talked about him all the time. She just adored him. So I always say that he really was the love of her life.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, from his point of view, he wrote a book. And I got to spend a day with Gene about a year before he died, which was pretty amazing. And he said to me he couldn't live with her and he couldn't live without her.
Huh.
And so I don't know. I mean, I think they're both, he was so sweet and so also childlike. So I could imagine they had a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. I find that very interesting that he told you that he couldn't live with Gilda and he couldn't live without her. Did he go into any more detail about that?
I think she was very needy in the sense there's like this famous story. It's not in the film. It's in her book. And everybody told me the story, and it never, ever made sense. So the story is that Gene married Gilda because her dog ate rat poison.
Really?
Yeah, and I was like, well, how did that work? And they're like, oh, well, Gene and Gilda were supposed to were flying to France, and her dog got sick. So she said to Gene, you fly without me. And she took care of the dog. And then when Gene got back, he said, you know, will you marry me? And he told me that story, too.
Yeah.
And so it was basically, it was the idea that she didn't need him as much. Like, she made an independent decision, which I think that's, their relationship was progressing in that way.
On Monday, October 20th, the phone rang. It was my internist. He checked me into the hospital immediately for tests. He said, very calmly, we've discovered there is a malignancy. I had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
How did she deal with this news?
Well, I think she had been, you know, we don't go into detail, that much detail in the film, because it is really hard to put, like, a whole story into somebody's life in an hour and a half. But she really was going to doctors for a while and not feeling well. And they were telling her that she was a hypochondriac or she had Epstein-Barr. And according to Jean's nephew, Jordan, she kept telling the doctors that she had cancer. And I think from what I heard, her diagnosis was really only a couple months to live. And she did wind up living 2.5 years and really sort of, you know, enjoying her life with Jean and with her friends and reconnecting with her SNL friends. So I think she was sad until, you know, she went to this place called the Wellness Community, which is the kind of the founding basis of Gilda's Club. And she met other people with cancer, and she was able to, you know, talk to people who were going through the same things that she was going through.
While she was sick, Gilda decided that she wanted to make cancer funny. So she asked for help from her old SNL writing partner, Alan Zweibel. How did Alan help Gilda make cancer funny?
Well, Alan and Gilda were really, after Gilda, Gilda had a long period of time, or at the beginning periods of Gene, she wasn't really with the SNL crowd, but her and Alan were always friends through thick and thin. And Alan was working on a show called It's Gary Shandling Show, and Gilda was supposed to be on the show before she was sick, actually, and or when she just got sick. And so she did a guest appearance on the show, and she makes fun of cancer. So her and Alan worked on their script. And I think, you know, I love the fact that Gilda was able to go back on television, was able to talk about cancer, and had that moment.
Hi, Gary.
Oh, Gilda, it's Gilda Radner, everybody.
Don't milk the applause like that. It's...
Oh, I'm sorry, Gary. I haven't been on television for a while.
Oh, that, yeah. What was wrong?
Oh, I had cancer. What did you have?
It's funny, and also it's poignant. It's a very memorable scene. What do you think is Gilda Radner's legacy?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's so many comedians, so many people in comedy are inspired by her.
Yeah.
I mean, she has a really solid place, I think. You know, she was inspired by, I mean, in terms of women, but also she inspires many, many people like Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Tina Fey, who are inspiring now a new generation of comedians who will inspire a new generation. So I think she has a pretty solid legacy there. And then in terms of Gilda's Clubs, you know, there's 18 of them. There's hundreds of thousands of people through the years who have been helped by these programs. So I think she has a pretty interesting legacy.
Yeah. At one point in your film, Gilda says that her biggest motivation has always been love.
Well, I think love is like the whole message of Gilda.
Yeah.
In general. That's why it's like the film was called Love Gilda from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would talk to people and they'd be like, I love Gilda.
Yeah.
And then I have all these letters from her where she actually signs Love, Gilda. But love was, I mean, all the people I talked to, you know, I interviewed maybe 70 people.
Wow.
You know, by phone.
Yeah.
A lot of people just by phone. And no one really, everyone was like, she was the sweetest, the nicest, the most giving, the most generous. So I think there's Gilda was not just somebody who wanted to be loved. She was somebody who really loved.
To be famous is more or less a stab at immortality.
A chance to leave your name and your work in the memory of millions of people.
Unfortunately,
it doesn't help you personally with being dead.
Because once you're dead, it really doesn't matter much to you about restaurants and what's on television.
I was thinking I'd like to be buried with a television at my feet, and I'd like to have my tombstone read,
Gilda Radner had a great time.
I just want to make sure anybody passing by my grave gets a good laugh.
A good, deep, mortal laugh, even if I don't hear it.
Lisa Dapolito is the director of the CNN Films documentary Love, Gilda. You can find out more about Lisa, her film, and Gilda at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Why are you ever immature?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
You're not too bright, are you?
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You sound like a real attractive guy.